session number 11214, reel 5.
Colonel Jourdain, reel 5. You were telling me about the attack at Messines and how you came out of the mineshaft into a battalion headquarters.
Yes, one went horizontally under both front lines and then up. And one, I forget how one came up this mineshaft, and at the top it appeared to be a big shell hole. There was one officer there, and he was a very good chaplain called Father Rafter, who must have been nearer 60 than 50. We know him, a very good chap. And the shaft came up into something like a large shell hole or something, which was the battalion headquarters. And he made the classic remark to me, and I've never forgotten it, "Jourdain, have a drink," because all the others were dead. And, of course, it was the most sensible remark man could have made. The shell had landed there and killed the battalion headquarters, that's what it amounted to. And then, this all sounds very disconnected. I had the drink. And I forget what the connection was. I and a chap called Dennis Wickham spent the rest of that day doing some signalling business with our 50 signals. I can't quite remember what, but it was just like a field day. Everything went like clockwork. The ground was so pulverised and dry that shells come down and drop about there, and all the metal went up like that. None of it went sideways, which is a normal thing. And we were perfectly happy sitting and having lunch with shells dropping about 10 yards away because of that curious situation.
So it had to be a direct hit, as had happened
exactly,
earlier.
Yes.
This was on the, I think in these notes, that it was the 7th Battalion of the Leinster Regiment. Would that be right?
Yes, that's quite true. It happened to be the 7th of June. But, The battalion headquarters, the 7th Battalion of the Leinster Regiment. I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but I had signalers from the whole of the brigade, about 40 or 50 signalers, and I thought I was very brave, because on the early part of that day, they got hold of a jar of rum, and I did the bravest thing I ever have done. I got hold of that said jar of rum and poured it on the ground, which didn't go down very well. It was 50 or 60 or whatever it was, Irish soldiers.
What did they do?
What?
What did they actually do?
Well, they made suitable noises, I think, but I lived to tell the tale. But it had been hopeless if they had got hold of it. Whatever we were supposed to do, and I can't quite remember what it was, would not have been done. But at any rate, the point about this machine show was it was just like a field day. Everything seemed to go according to plan. Streams of German prisoners kept on coming back. This man, Wickham, and I, who were some of them in the O'Connor Rangers, had a very good time. And my batman, very kindly, got some field got hold of some German rations, which were to be got round there at that time, served us a very good lunch, for which we got him the military medal for taking messages under for heavy fire, which we thought was about fair. And he in turn made several things like that. There's some of them in this room. This is one of them later on, as a token of esteem and respect from shells.
An ashtray made
ashtray
from a shell.
Yes. And this is all trivial, but it was a very pleasant time, this battle.
But you were under heavy fire, but it wasn't effective.
Yes, no, it really is quite true. Shells would land a matter of a yard or two away, and they'd go down through this dusty ground and explode upwards, no sideways effect. It was amazing. It made life quite pleasant.
Did the concussion affect you at all?
Funny you should say that, because not then, but a day or two afterwards, I wondered what was happening, because anything that went off bang, over there somewhere, made me jump. And I suddenly realised I'd got this thing called shell shock, which I'd never believed in before. Simply, I think, because of all these shells going off quite close to one, there was a lot of concussion about it. And I realised this, and I didn't know what to do, because I wasn't going to tell anybody about it. And I didn't tell anybody about it. And fortunately, after, I should say, 3 days, or maybe more, but something like that, it disappeared. But was I relieved? Because, I mean, you felt, am I a coward or what? I mean, this is dreadful. I mean, anything that goes pop makes one dither. And, of course, that is what shell shock is, I think. Why hadn't believed in it before.
You hadn't believed in it before. What had you thought? Why hadn't you believed in it? And
people always thought it was cowardice, you see, because people got shell shock in a front line trench, perfectly legitimately, no doubt, and would start. I suppose they got dithery, but at any rate, anything that went off bang alarmed them, and eventually they presumably got home. It was one way of getting home.
And so before you got it yourself, you felt that they were faking it deliberately?
Oh, yes, to a certain extent, at any rate.
Did you ever see any of the more serious shell shock, which is not dithering, which is sort of losing complete control?
No, I never saw it. Fortunately, I did never see anything serious or anything. You see, people, if they realised, like I did, that there's something wrong, you'd do your best to hide it. Because you're scared thinking that you're being a coward.
Were you able to control your...
Oh, yes, it wasn't bad, because the fact that it passed off in 2 or 3 days presumably indicates... I think it was simply concussion, I suppose, is another word for it. All these things were going off bang very close on June the 7th, and it's probably a direct result of that. Nobody knew anything about it. I don't think I've ever told anybody about it.
Do you remember anything else of that period, of the actual Battle of Messines? Anything else come to mind?
No, just streams of an unusual sight, streams of German prisoners coming over. Everything seemed to be like a field day. I mean, there was...
What state were the German prisoners in?
Perfectly orderly and that kind of thing. They didn't. I thought they were glad to be out of the war.
Did they look reasonably uniformed? And
they did then, yes. I think they were glad to be out of it.
Now, this was... You'd been working on a sort of brigade appointment here. And it wasn't so long after this that you got sent to brigade headquarters as brigade signal officer and brigade intelligence officer. How did that all come about? How were you beginning to get these increased contacts with brigade?
I don't know, except that you see, that business at Messines and this other chap there, I was a nominee, so to speak, of the brigade. I mean, I had soldiers of war, signalers of war battalions under me, and I was connected with the brigade quite a lot and continued to be so, really, almost for the rest of the war. Because I got... it'll come out. I got more or less adopted as a potential staff officer and that kind of thing. And if the war had gone on longer, which God forbid, I'd got on a sort of bandwagon, if you like, that would sent me to Cambridge. Because in Cambridge was a place where they had... I forgot whether it was called a junior staff course or something other staff course. And this is jumping some way forward. For the I'll leave that alone.
How did you get this first job because you were appointed brigade signals officer and brigade intelligence officer in 17. When did that come about?
The steps are usually signal officer, brigade signal officer, and then might be something from that. And that's what did happen, in fact. I mean, I was... it'll come out later on over one or two things. I was very much, somehow or other, got attached to that 47 Brigade headquarters for the rest of the war, off and on.
Well, let's move on to that then, because the next thing that you remember after Messines then.
Well, Messines, the next thing is Third Battle of Ypres, which wasn't long after. Messines was June the 7th, 1917, and the Third Battle of Ypres was July the 31st. In other words, things were boiling up for the Third Battle of Ypres then. And I forget what I was in the Third Battle of Ypres, but I can remember. I must have been either brigade signal officer or what was called a staff learner. But in any case, I was the boy about the brigade headquarters, and I saw quite a lot of what went on, I can put it like that, in the Third Battle of Ypres. It was a ghastly place. I mean, everything was ghastly, mud, bombardments, and the Lord knows what all. I mean, people getting killed right... left and centre. It was getting a bit like the Somme over again, you see, that kind of thing. And I was apparently, I don't know what I was doing, but I was probably brigade intelligence officer or something of that sort. But I saw quite a lot of what was going on and what didn't.
Could you describe, we haven't been able to talk to many people who were at brigade headquarters at this time for obvious reasons.
Yes.
Could you describe the setup of a brigade headquarters and what the jobs of the various staff officers there were? At that time,
an old gentleman called Pereira was the brigade commander. I mean, he had been the brigade commander in that division from its beginning of its existence until now. He was a retired brevet colonel in the Grenville Guards, a very nice old man who had a game leg and limped, but was a very fine soldier, I'll say that without any hesitation. He lasted until some point about late 17. He knew the brigade inside out. In spite of being a lame man with a bad leg, he was always round the front line every day, that kind of man, you see. And because of this brigade signal officer business, I got more or less taken on as the, I don't know what you call it, staff learner is the official name, but I mean assistant to the brigade major, put it like that.
Well, let's take it down here. Who else would be at the brigade headquarters? If we look at the organisation...
Brigade commander, brigade major.
What was the brigade major? Do you remember his name at the time?
Well, there were several of them, but... their faces, not their names.
Doesn't matter.
I'll find out.
What was their job then? What did they?
They were the general staff officer. A brigade major is the general staff officer at the brigade headquarters, with a staff captain who is the administrative staff officer. The brigade command, the brigade major in nearly all brigades was very often a regular officer. I mean, a pre-war regular officer.
And what did he actually do?
He issued orders in writing and so on behalf of the brigade commander. He was the chap who rarely knew what was going on in the whole brigade and was not concerned with rations and things like that, which the staff captain was. Nearly all brigades had a brigade signalling officer, of course. I was that for a bit. But
and what did that entail?
I'm not altogether sure, because I never did it for any length of time, but it's more a question of supervising the battalion signalling officers and seeing communications between the battalion and the brigade were all right, that kind of thing. But... I suppose, for one reason or another, I always appeared to be a kind of extra staff officer. And to jump a long way forward, I didn't know it, but this was all leading to sending me on the Cambridge course, which was a 6 or 8 month affair. I must jump this a little bit forward in a moment, because while my predecessors, GSO 3 of the division, went on that course, I was doing GSO 3 of the division unpaid. That's jumping ahead a bit. As a brigade, nearly all brigades had somebody who was a staff learner, an extra of some sort, to do this, that, and the other, if only to be somebody who could hold the fort while the brigade major was up in the front line, that kind of thing. You could always use an extra staff officer at a brigade headquarters if the brigade was in the line.
Now, the brigade intelligence officer was another job. That you held for a while, and
it's all part of the same thing. I mean,
what was that? What was that? His function? How did he operate?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I used to write little poems to the battalion intelligence officers, who'd write little poems back to me, which were called intelligence reports. They all rhymed. It was good, clean fun. The whole idea was, theoretically, one was collecting information from the battalions and sending it back to the division, but it was very nominal. And we all knew each other and enjoyed life quite a lot. I mean, enjoyed official life quite a lot. And like most of these things, the war was settling down. There must be a report into divisional headquarters by midday every day or something of that sort. And, of course, in that position, where a brigade headquarters is a very small thing, there's the brigadier, the brigade major, the staff captain, and brigade signal officer, and sometimes a learner. And one began to know how a brigade is run, and one... could and did very often act for the brigade major rather than more than the staff captain. And one got noticed, I suppose. That's another side to it. And for some time, that brigade worked very happily like that. And with you'll find all brigades had an extra body, and the extra body was somebody like me who was eventually going to go on a staff course or something. In the meantime, did a staff officer's job.
Were there any other staff officers there that you can think of besides the ones we've already mentioned?
They would have had nothing to do with the 16th Irish Division. I mean, they were posted there as an MS job, you know, a military secretary's appointment.
At the brigade level at the moment.
Yes, I mean at the brigade level. There were various brigade majors, and I can't remember their names, but I can remember their faces quite well. And they, as a rule, they were very often regular officers, quite often PSC. But they rarely ran the brigade, if the brigade commander was an elderly gentleman or something like that. And eventually,
You were doing this during the Third Battle of Ypres on one of these, you know, as a supernumerary and various signal officers.
And of course one saw a lot of what's going on, because one was wandering around the front quite a lot.
What did you think of what was going on? I mean, did you have an opinion about the strategy and tactics employed, or were you still a bit junior for that?
One was too junior, but one thought everything was inevitable. I mean, there was... what one could not bear was the awful apparent wastage of human life for no particular purpose. I mean, the whole of the Third Battle of Ypres, like the Battle of the Somme for that matter, was a matter of going over a piece of ground about that, 10 miles may have been or something like that, and enormous casualties. And the only thing that both those battles did was to wear down the number of the soldiers in the German army at some fantastic cost.
And did you realize?
And nobody ever could say stop. I think that's the thing one thought, why in God's name can't they stop it? Particularly with the Third Battle of Ypres. I mean, one was an observer, I was very much there. And nobody seemed to be getting anywhere. I mean, getting, you know, about 100 yards.
You felt that at the time then?
Oh, yes. Because one was leading this rather independent life, which I had.
Did you feel at all embarrassed by your position as a staff officer? You know, sort of, whilst sort of set apart from the battalion?
The battalion, of course, had changed a lot.
In what way?
Well, people had been wounded, sick, gone home, and other people had come out, and I didn't really know them awfully well. I knew the brigade as a whole better than the 6 Connaught Rangers as such. And brigades, I knew all the brigade intelligence officers and the brigade signalling officers. We all knew each other, what's more. We were still more or less, I can't say boys, but young chaps who knew each other.
So you were starting to find that you knew more people at brigade level and amongst the professions of signalling officers, intelligence officers, than you did company officers within your own battalion.
That's true. I was having a very pleasant life, I may as well say that. I mean, I did. Because it was interesting. It's difficult to say how responsible one was, I mean, the job. But one could, with one solitary exception, one could always act for the brigade major if the brigade major was away. And there was one classic occasion later on, we'll probably come to it, where I told the 47th Division, a division, that it could advance 10 miles and forgot to make arrangements for the rations.
We'll be coming to that.
That'll be later.
During the Battle of Ypres, are there any incidents you remember in particular, or is it just a...
No, only sort of things like walking up the Menin Road, being with somebody else, I forget, and knowing that suddenly there will be a German 5.9s sending about 10 shells across like that. You would keep off the road when you saw it happening. You would then go on up the road, know it's about time for the next lot, and the Germans, being very methodical, did the same thing again. And you were able to sort of keep safe in what was really a horrendous situation. I mean, 5.9s are big shells. And I don't know what...
Were the Germans that methodical? I mean,
they're inclined to be methodical, yes. But having read one, two books of people who were young chaps in the German army on the other side, they appear to be much more casual than one would have thought.
But as you thought, I mean, it seemed to you, as you were doing things like going at the Menin Road, that you could time where...
Yes, one did, and yes.
And you made decisions based on the presumption that they fire every so-and-so.
Yes, and the Germans are inclined to do that, being very methodical.
What else do you remember? Do you have any recollection of any of the ground conditions?
The ground conditions were appalling, of course, at Ypres. I mean, the places, and it was solid mud. Now, if you go to the Somme now, you'll see country that looks just like this. It's all trees and so on, and this bears no resemblance to the appearance of the Somme as it was then, because the trees had all gone, the place looked dreadful, and now it's all trees again and agricultural land. I've been to Ypres since, and it's very reminiscent. There are much fewer trees and so forth than there were further south. And at Loos, I can almost... Oh, I beg your pardon. At Loos, one can almost imagine the guns going off now, because the place is a lot of slag heaps and things like that, and it looks just as it always did. So that's quite...
How did the mud of Ypres compare with the Somme?
Well, I think Ypres mud was much more lasting, I suppose, than the Somme. The Somme was wet clay, that's quite true. But we went, one was only there a very short time. And the thing about the Somme was the noise of the bombardment, which was really too appalling to describe. Ypres was not quite as intense as that. But Ypres was this infernal clay. I mean, if you put your foot in it, it was very difficult to take it out again. No, that sort of thing.
Did you ever go up as far as the front line? I mean, right up to the front, or would you just...
At Ypres?
As a staff officer, how far forward would you get?
Probably not further than battalion headquarters, which at Ypres might mean anywhere, quite close to the front line, in fact. It was a very almost disorganized part of the world. So was the Somme, for that matter, too. But it was rather difficult to see where the front line was at Ypres. I mean, things have become so chaotic. Mud and holes and explosions and so on. I think it's quite difficult.
Did that make it difficult to control things from brigade headquarters when you were...
Oh, I think so, yes. It was very difficult to know what was going on. I think I must have been sent up to find out what was going on. I'm a bit vague about what I was doing.
What about... were you still doing this when you... during? Because your battalion... Well, the brigade was involved at Cambrai as well in November.
No. When was the German breakthrough? 21st of March 1918, wasn't it? By then, we were somewhere else, and I was at that doing acting G3 of the division.
Right, hang on.
I think we're jumping ahead a bit.
I meant Cambrai.
I wasn't at Cambrai in any sense, I don't think. I seem to remember being somewhere around there and sleeping in a railway cutting, but I don't quite know what, and I didn't know very much what was going on. It wasn't very intense.
When did you get the transfer from brigade to division?
Well, I'm not quite sure whether it happened once or twice, but I don't know whether I'm getting chronologically out of step, but March the 21st, 1918 upset all the apple carts. You know, that's when the German breakthrough.
But you were already with the division then, weren't you?
No, I wasn't, I don't think. I had been, but I wasn't. But for some reason or other, I had been asked to go back to the battalion as adjutant. And did. I'm a bit vague about the proper sequence. But everything went wrong, sort of, in France after March the 21st, 1918.
Because... In some of your notes, you've got a reference to the fact that you were there at Divisional HQ as staff learner, and you actually found out, everybody knew, but one of the things you learned was that there was going to be a bigger German offensive in the spring, and asked for leave as a result.
That's true, yes.
Could you tell us about that? Because you were trying to get your leave in before it happened.
Well, that's what it was.
What indications would you have, or did you have, that there was going to be an offensive? How could you tell that?
Well, I suppose there were daily or weekly intelligence reports, which probably indicated it.
You don't remember now what the indicators were?
No, not offhand. But I presume the preponderance of artillery in one part of the front is compared to the artillery in another part of the front. I mean, when the artillery began to, which of course was firing all the time, began to get very pronounced, and there's a certain amount of air reconnaissance and that kind of thing, which helped to indicate that they were massing for something somewhere, and the somewhere would become more or less definite. And I did go, that's quite true, go home on leave, and it happened while I was on leave, because I came back and couldn't get any further than Havre. I was sent down to Havre, I think, and eventually came up from Havre and found everything was completely different. Everything had been smashed up. The 16th Irish Division then consisted of one Irish brigade and two Portuguese brigades. All sorts of curious things happened. And I get a bit muddled over it. But after it had all blown over, I somehow or other got sent to the 5th Battalion of the Connaught Rangers, who had come from Palestine or somewhere, that's right, and were now in another division in France.
Now, there was an interval, I believe, where you were sent home. I mean, you were with the 6th in Aldershot. An interval there. The division was ordered to England to be reformed at Aldershot.
Oh, and I'd forgotten all about that, but I wasn't with them then. I was not with them, anyway, for one reason or another. They went home, and I just... they went home, I suppose, as a result of March the 21st, 1918. Must have been that.
I think what happened was that the division went back, but you rejoined the 6th Battalion for a period training American troops
that's
in
right.
France.
That's right.
And could you just tell me what you were doing there?
About a dozen of us, certainly not more, were all bumped up to being acting captains, brackets without pay, for the benefit of the Americans, to teach the Americans of the 38th Division or something like that how to use the small magazine, the Enfield rifle. And some of us from the 6th Connaught Rangers then, about half a dozen of us, were all dressed up as captains to impress the Americans. We all had our horses. We all said we will ride round at some Christian hour like 9 a.m. to see what's going on. If you Americans like to parade at 6:30, that's your affair. But we will just ride round and see that you're using the rifle properly. And that, believe it or not, went on for a month or two, and then it packed up. But it is quite true. We were all solemnly made acting captains to impress the Americans, but of course without pay. So my first small medals have got captain on it, because they always put the highest rank you had. It was just about as phony as any rank could be. But it was simply and solely to impress the Americans.
It sounds as if the training you gave them wasn't too serious in the...
No, they were training themselves. You know, they have a colonel commands a regiment, which is the equivalent of a brigade, but he personally commands it and can fire people and do all sorts of things. And they were just learning how to use the British rifle. This lot.
And so you were just... very hands-off supervision.
We had some NCOs who did the work.
So you were just...
We added the glamour and rode round looking like officers and gents.
What did you think of the Americans? I mean,
very little, of course, but they were like Boy Scouts, of course, in those days.
In what way?
Well, very simple, I think, of course, there's this autocratic system. I mean, there's the colonel who commanded a regiment, the equivalent of a brigade, was a very powerful man. I mean, he could hire and fire. I mean, if he didn't like an officer, he could break him. But that just lasted, I don't know how long, perhaps 2 or 3 months at the minute.
Did this strike you as good material, good military material? Did you think that they'd make competent fighting troops, or what did you think?
Well, honestly, you know, one thought of people like that as cannon fodder. I mean, because they're not, I'm being unkind about it, because that's about what they were likely to be. They were, of course, physically a good lot. I mean, they were young men, and but whether they were competent soldiers or not, I really don't know, because very little depended on the soldiers in that time of the war until it got moving.